The following programming is sponsored by Dr. Joseph Fallon Jr. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
It's time once again to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. brings you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. Now, here is Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. with another edition of Inside Medicine.
Good morning, Philadelphia and New Jersey. Thank you for tuning in to Inside Medicine. I'm happy to say that I'm going to be the only presenter today. But next week, we will have a superb podiatrist on coming, and I anticipate that he's going to have an excellent show. So next week is going to be diabetic podiatry, and we are going to learn a lot about prevention and what how those feet can go wrong. Let me just open up with a little bit of good news. The economy is growing at a solid pace, reported Fed Chair Jerome Powell, which absolutely made everybody happy. Additionally, yesterday was Apple's iPhone 16, which is now on the market as of yesterday, and hopefully Apple will continue to do well. They've certainly had some challenges. On September 23rd, basically, there was a 35-year average of 19 times growth with that company. Happy to say that. Apple continues to thrive. Additionally, Three Mile Island, the site of the worst radioactive disaster in the United States history, will be reopening, and it will sell its power generated exclusively to Microsoft, who's got to make sure that they've got enough energy to help those phones go and everything else that they support. Let me ask you a question. How does the U.S. government balance drug prices with the need to maintain innovation? That is an issue because basically we've seen a push to have the government decrease drug pricing and just, you know, level the boom on and people who are inventors who made things happen. My impression is that that has a risk, and hopefully that can be adjudicated well. If cancer hits you, are you better off in 2024? Do you think if the government can tell everybody what to do in terms of their prices, do you think that the ability of industry to move forward is going to move forward or not? I'm a little bit afraid that that's not the case. I do note that we take a look at the insulin market. The government has stated that now it wants people to be able to buy insulin at $35 or $25 a vial. The problem is that there's a limited people who can get that price. And then if you go to Walmart, basically, if you just go to the counter and take out a bottle of insulin, I think they'll sell it to you for $35. The problem is those people who have been excluded from that potential option are now facing prices that have gone up over $100 for a vial. So my impression is there's something good, but there's something bad. And is the government doing the right thing? I really fear what the government will do with chemotherapy-type items, which are much more expensive than insulin. But additionally, just in my own office, we used to get samples for insulin. That has been cut off with the $35 a vial deal, which we will survive. But they just took away a nicety that we could give patients in the office a bottle to go home or a pen to go home. So let me just introduce an issue that was published in the Annals of Internal Medicine. It's the association of semaglutide, which is a GLP-1 drug, with tobacco use disorder in patients with type 2 diabetes. The overall output is that the semaglutide was associated with a lower risk of tobacco-related disorders. Basically, that the people who were on semaglutide had a very nice reduction in 30 days of decreasing the tobacco use they used, and a lot were able to get off. So semaglutide was associated with lower risk for both incidence and relapse of cannabis use disorder, which is a positive for a lot of families, which is frequently associated with cigarette smoking. So again, here we have a positive, semaglutide basically decreasing tobacco use, which long-term should help. The changes are, how long will this persist? But tobacco use disorder just got a shot in the knee, not for good, but for bad because of the semaglutide utilization. I have to tell you that the semaglutide has certainly revolutionized endocrinology. It's revolutionized medicine. The results are incredibly good. If you take a look at people, you're seeing that a lot of them are slimming down. You're seeing them that their diabetes is getting better. Just tremendous benefits are occurring with semaglutide use. Now, there was a recent publication called the Dandelion Health Clinical AI Marketplace shows GLP-1s may help prevent cardiovascular disease for 44 million previously unstudied U.S. patients. So this is artificial intelligence creeping in. Dandelion layered validated unbiased AI from its new clinical AI marketplace against its real-world data to demonstrate the potential preventive impact of GLP-1 drug class for a 7 times larger population than those previously studied. Obviously, they brought in AI, and in doing so, they could generate more information for more people that were never caught. So this was obviously considered a large study that demonstrated that GLP-1 medications may be effective as primary prevention for cardiovascular disease for 44 million additional at-risk patients who had not been studied. The study was conducted using validated AI-accessible Dandelion Clinical AI Marketplace, which also officially launched today. Dandelion's Clinical AI Artificial Intelligence Marketplace enables life science organizations to conduct novel scientific research at a fraction of the time and cost of clinical trial, and far more comprehensively than using traditional methods of generating data. Dandelion's marketplace also hosts AI algorithms sourced from a rapidly growing ecosystem of clinical AI developers. The company validates those algorithms for performance and equity and runs them at robust, representative, real-world data to generate rapid, novel insights that researchers can analyze along with other patient data. So even though it has an extremely high value, as much as 80%, a real world is unstructured and accessible and found in formats like imaging files, waveforms, and raw clinical notes that information can be gleaned. So in other words, you do an EKG, and the EKG gives us what we want to know, but there's a lot of other data in there. And these artificial intelligence can review the waveforms on your EKG and predict other issues. And that's essentially what's happening. Major cardiovascular events, MACE, was narrowly focused on obese, non-diabetic adult patients with pre-existing severe coronary vascular disease. Dandelion's study considered, quote, clinically silent patients not included in this trial, those with a past adverse cardiovascular disease event or evidence pre-existing severe cardiovascular disease. The Dandelion was able to assess waveforms that had never been done before and generate significant information so that they felt that they can potentially influence 34,000 fewer myocardial infarcts and strokes annually. The cost and time associated with drug development and commercializations are substantial, but the impact of providing the right treatment to the right patient and doing so with unprecedented speed is immeasurable for the billions of people who depend on innovative drugs and therapies, said Eileen Green, co-founder and CEO of Dandelion Health. The overall indication here is they are able to weed out information that was never weeded out before and to basically generate significant improvement in cardiovascular health. So let's just go back a little bit into cardiovascular health. So major adverse cardiovascular events, MACE, is a composite endpoint frequently used in cardiovascular disease assessment. Clinically, 3-point ACE is defined as a composite of non-fatal stroke, non-fatal MI, and cardiovascular death. There are other issues that can be added in, such as heart failure, ischemic cardiovascular events, cardiac death, and myocardial infarct. Basically, what happens is the incidence of perioperative myocardial infarction is about 0.9%. This is a large percentage of patients experience or perioperative increase in cardiac troponins without other criteria for MI. Factors associated with increased risk of MACE, advanced age, high American Society anesthesiologist class rank, kidney disease, anemia, surgery type of procedure, all that can be added in. And assessments of things such as non-STEMI, where the patient gets a heart attack but does not really hit through the entire muscle, those people are assessed. And that basically they can add in issues such as anemia, hypotension, hypoxia, pain, tachycardia, and find out that the aspirin and low-dose beta blocker should be initiated within 24 hours. Basically, other interventions are done. So the bottom line is that this particular company has indicated that they will improve medical care tremendously by utilizing AI. I certainly am not an expert on AI, but basically the results seem to be very impressive on that data can be weaned from the data points that were never utilized and make things better. What about things like angiotensin converting enzyme inhibitors? The data indicates should be started in patients with an ejection fraction of less than 40%, hypertension or diabetes, including those with stable kidney disease. So basically the data that is fed in can come up with a computer analysis and generate increased interactions for patients that will make them live longer, such as the initiation of ACE inhibitors. ACE inhibitors are used in diabetics all the time. The question is, let's make sure that we can add them to things such as myocardial infarct to generate significant improvement in cardiovascular heart outcome. Let me indicate the use of an intra-aortic balloon pump. That's where an individual's blood is switched off into a machine as opposed to their lungs. And volatile anesthetic agents and transfusions basically can be more assessed by this AI. And they're predicting a significant improvement. To reduce mortality and prevent MACE in patients with chronic stable coronary artery disease, beta blockers are a mainstay of therapy in chronic stable CAD. However, there's little evidence exists that beta blockers prolong the results is improved survival or lower rate. And this is coming up in a study of over 20,000 patients that were and were not treated with beta blockers demonstrated no statistically significant difference in the rates of MACE between patients with established coronary artery disease and no prior MI follow-up for nearly 4 years. But what we're really seeing here is that they're basically allowing physicians to reassess quickly, should a beta blocker be added? What's the pros and cons, and will the patient do much better? Guidelines for chronic stable coronary disease management with the use of beta blockers in patients with prior MI or history of heart failure, but not in other patients with a chronic stable coronary disease. It will pinpoint exactly what needs to be done for these patients. For instance, drugs that have been used, will they be deleted? Either nifedipine nor amlodipine reduce the rates of cardiovascular death or MI and chronic stable angina. These medications are excellent for blood pressure control, but it's not going to help somebody with a cardiovascular death around the corner and chronic stable angina moving to acute angina. So again, this particular study is very impressive. And I have to say that it's going to be very good for cardiologists. It's going to be good for patients. And this AI is going to move medicine forward, which I think is fantastic. Let me just move on to diabetic retinopathy. So diabetic retinopathy is the leading cause of new cases of blindness in patients with diabetes. In 2020, more than 103 million individuals with diabetes worldwide were affected by diabetic retinopathy, and estimates suggest this number will increase to 160 million by 2040. Compared with all other leading causes of blindness, diabetic retinopathy is the only condition that has not experienced a decrease in age-standardized prevalence between 1990 and 2020, which is, by my count, 30 years. Without proper prevention and management, the burden of diabetic retinopathy will continue to grow, placing more patients at risk for complications that can cause severe vision loss, such as diabetic macular edema and proliferative diabetic retinopathy. That's where the blood vessels are seeking to go out into the ocular bed. Diabetic retinopathy is classified as non-proliferative diabetic retinopathy and proliferative diabetic retinopathy based on the presence of abnormal or new blood vessels growing in the retina. So in other words, when your doctor or ophthalmologist goes in and takes a look at the back of your eye, what are the blood vessels doing? If they're growing and growing wildly, they tend to break and cause bleeding, which decreases your vision tremendously. So is there something that can be done by diabetic retinopathy treatment? Good diabetes is important. Getting to the eye doctor is very important. So what are the American Diabetes Association screening recommendations for diabetic retinopathy in different patient populations? So to make this simple, type 1 diabetic, somebody who gets it usually in their 20s, it can be later, but usually in their 20s. And even earlier, we know that sometimes the children's hospital has, you know, the kids who are much younger with diabetes and has to make all sorts of adjustments, gyrations. And of course, they have a well-known reputation for treating patients well, including the family. So what about eye check? If you're a type 1 diabetic, which means you're insulin dependent, the recommendation for an initial eye exam is within 5 years after onset of type 1. And after that, it should be done annually. If you're a type 2 diabetic, because type 2 diabetics are generally assessed with a number of time after they've been really had the disease, the recommendation of the American Diabetes Association that you should get an eye exam by an ophthalmologist at time of diagnosis of type 2 diabetes, right on the spot, kind of like if you get diagnosed in the hospital or treated. There's a recommendation to go see your local ophthalmologist, or at times, even if screened in the hospital, a retina specialist. The answer is they should be seen on an annually basis. What about pre-existing diabetes and planning on pregnancy? Very, very important. Basically, if you're going to get pregnant and you have diabetes, they recommend you see your ophthalmologist before. We do note that pregnancy can advance retinopathy and that you need to be monitored, and your ophthalmologist will help out on that. Every trimester and up to one year postpartum, the patient should be assessed. I do note that if there's a consideration of gestational diabetes, initial eye exam is not required, nor is follow-up. So, other items to check out if you are worried about diabetic eye disease is, what about your lipid profile? Obviously, they want your A1C test to be low, as close to normal as possible, without complications of low blood sugar. They want to make sure that you have no diabetic active peripheral neuropathy where things are perking too much. And you want to also be watching for clinically significant macular edema. So again, it's kind of hard even for myself to see macular edema. Even though I look at a lot of eyes, the ophthalmologist or the pros, they can dilate and check things out. Now, what about eye disease and elevated cholesterol and triglyceride levels? They've been indicated as risk factors for diabetic retinopathy. So we have basically a big push to make sure that diabetics have excellent diabetic eye control. We also want to make sure is, how do we make sure that diabetic retinopathy does not come around the corner? There is a study called the ACCORD trial, which did an intensive glycemic control and treatment of dyslipidemia in patients with type 2 diabetes. Lipoprotein triglycerides were averaging 162, low-density lipoprotein 93, and the study reduced the rate of diabetic retinopathy progression with intensive glycemic control combined with fenofibrate and simvastatin therapy. The was called the field study reported a decreased need for laser treatment in patients with diabetic retinopathy treated with fenofibrate. Other studies reported that statin therapy decreased the risk and incidence of diabetic neuropathy. So again, we've now had medications adding into ophthalmologic visitations. And if the patient has that hyperlipidemia, which certainly can be negative for heart, but it also can be negative for retinopathy. So again, what's your LDL? What's your bad cholesterol? What does the whole lipid profile show? So coronary artery disease, deaths, and also all-cause mortality are always considered in this. Remember, your cardiologist usually is trying to generate your bad cholesterol down to 76, which gives you a 40-plus decrease in MI, stroke, and death. So again, cardiovascular control is important even for eyes. What about blood pressure? A Cochrane review showed that although intensive blood pressure control was associated with reduced risk of diabetic retinopathy development, it did not significantly impact progression of existing diabetic retinopathy compared with less stringent measures of blood pressure control. So indicating that blood pressure is very important in diabetic eye disease, and that makes things better. Now, so again, the increased risk for diabetic retinopathy seems to occur early in treatment and may be transient, ranging from 3 months to 3 years after starting GLP-1 treatment. A plausible explanation is that potential early increase in diabetic retinopathy with GLP-1 receptor agonists is a drastic decrease in A1C that occurs when intensively managing diabetes. That you would think would be a positive. So again, when you improve diabetes aggressively, sometimes that does cause the retina to enhance quick speed and cause a problem. That's why basically if you're on medications that are going to help out that cholesterol level, sometimes a follow-up visit in 3 to 6 months with the ophthalmologist would be most appropriate. So it's kind of hard to believe that if you improve your diabetes aggressively, can it generate retinopathy, that is an issue. So you need to be checked. So overall, GLP-1 receptor agonists have clear benefit in weight loss and cardiovascular risk, hypoglycemic risk, and kidney risk management and kidneys. The progression of diabetic retinopathy should be carefully considered. So again, do the GLP-1s, can they associate an increase in diabetic retinopathy? Regretfully, the answer is yes. Primary care physicians should prioritize management of diabetes mellitus with a target A1C of 7% or lower, while being mindful of large reduction in A1C when starting diabetic medications, such as GLP-1 agonists can induce retinopathy flare. So again, you want to get checked. The GLP-1s, though, definitely have major benefits in many areas. And we're happy to say that, thank God, things are getting better. Okay, let me just move on. So again, we're going to go hitting this GLP-1 stuff pretty heavy today. Clinical antidotes that patients treated with semaglutide, the glucagon-like polypeptide receptor agonist, approved for the type 2 diabetes mellitus in 2017 for diabetes, and 2021 for obesity, reported reduced desire to smoke have attracted attention about its potential benefits for smoking cessation. So semaglutide was associated with lower risk for both incidence and relapse of cannabis use disorder. So we're now moving on to tobacco use disorder in patients with type 2 diabetes mellitus. We do know that cigarette smoking tends to constrict small blood vessels, which can cause long-term problems. Tobacco is the leading preventable risk factor for premature deaths worldwide, accounting to an estimated 7.7 million annual deaths globally. Mortality from tobacco use reflects its contribution to various types of cancer and pulmonary, cardiac, and vascular diseases, including stroke and diabetes, among others. So again, is the GLP-1 drug going to help people stop smoking? The answer is yes. So can cannabis use disorder be influenced by GLP-1s? The answer is yes. Semaglutide was associated with changes in healthcare use measured by tobacco use, smoking cessation, prescriptions, and counseling. These measures were further assessed in subpopulations without a diagnosis of obesity. So among patients with no diagnosis of obesity, semaglutide was associated with decreased risk of smoking cessation, counseling, and was significant compared with metformin and sulfonylureas. The benefit continued to improve by utilizing SGLT1-2s and plateaued at 180 days. Let's move on to a different topic. The New England Journal of Medicine published in August an article called Sexual Dysfunction in Women. Because there is no universal definition of normal sexual function, what constitutes sexual difficulty is determined by a person's subjective definition of unsatisfactory sexual well-being. The condition is usually described as unsatisfactory interest, arousal, orgasm, or other aspects of sexuality, and the symptoms often coexist. The term sexual dysfunction, quotes, is used when at least one of the symptoms of substantial concern to the affected person arise. Sexual dysfunction negatively affects mental health, vitality, social functioning, and has an overall effect on quality of life that is similar magnitude to that associated with chronic back pain or diabetes. There's an international classification of disease and related health problems called the ICD-10, and the ICD has recently, 11 has come out, recognized that sexual response is influenced by a complex interplay of biologic, psychologic, and social factors. Hence, sexual dysfunction is no longer defined as either related to or caused by a disease or medication, or independent of an identifiable cause. This change is clinically important because it allows for associated factors to be recognized and, when possible, managed, but does not prevent persons with associated factors from receiving treatment for sexual dysfunction. The sexual dysfunction has been put into the ICD-11. Which no longer characterize all sexual dysfunction according to male or female sex, because most determinants of sexual response are not sex-specific. Only arousal disorder in women and erectile dysfunction in men remain categorized as sex-specific sexual dysfunctions. Sexual dysfunction in women is common and is associated with impaired well-being and quality of life. Many women with sexual dysfunction will not seek care unless prompted by their healthcare provider. However, there are no evidence-based screening recommendations for sexual dysfunction as part of routine health care. Sexual well-being is determined by a complex interplay of biologic, psychologic, and sociocultural factors. Therefore, an assessment of sexual dysfunction involves a comprehensive review of the patient's general health and psychologic circumstances and a history of the patient's use of prescription and non-prescription medications and other drugs. In other words, is the drugs you're taking associated with sexual dysfunction? Management pathways for sexual dysfunction include lifestyle modification, counseling, psychosexual therapies, physical therapy, and pharmacologic therapy. What is the prevalence of sexual dysfunction in women? A German study involving 2,050 women, 19.4% of the younger participants, 18 to 24 years of age, and 31.5% of older participants, 46 to 55 years, had low desire, hypoactive sexual desire dysfunction with severe distress in the previous 12 months was reported in 6.2% of participants in the younger age group and 7.3% of participants in the older age group. 10,554 women who answered validated questionnaires showed that 27.4% and 58.9% of women 18 to 24 years of age and the higher dose 45 to 49 years of age respectively had low desire, and 12.2% and 31% respectively had hypoactive sexual desire dysfunction. The most common sexual difficulty with associated distress in women younger than 40 years of age is poor sexual self-image, a characteristic that was observed in 13.4% of women of this age group in a large Australian study. Risk factors for low sexual image dysfunction include breastfeeding, overweight and obesity, and having a partner. A disturbing finding was that 30% of the participants scored above the threshold for sexual-related personal distress, but did not have a specific sexual difficulty. Contributing health conditions. Estrogen insufficiency is the hallmark of menopause, hypothalamic amenorrhea, hyperprolactinemia, that's when a gal gets milk from their breast, hypopituitarism, effect of the pituitary gland, anti-estrogen therapy such as aromatase inhibitors generate low sexual desire and may be related to estrogen insufficiency. Symptoms such as hot flashes and night sweats, mood changes and sleep disturbance or vulvovaginal dryness can be remedied. Low testosterone levels have not been consistently associated with low orgasm satisfaction. However, in one analysis, when social demographic factors were taken into consideration, low T was independently associated with low orgasm satisfaction in premenopausal women. Serum testosterone levels have not been consistently associated with sexual function in postmenopausal women, but representative studies that use a more precise measurement of testosterone are still needed. Chronic disease, particularly conditions that reduce mobility or cause chronic pain, mental health conditions, pelvic organ prolapse, and cancer therapy may all contribute to sexual dysfunction. A number of social factors are evident. Let's take a look at the prevalence of sexual dysfunction in representative sample of 10,554 women in a community-based Australian study. Women 18 to 39 years of age completed the profile of female sexual function, and all others completed the female sexual function index, another issue of assessment. Responses of never or seldom to the question, how often in the past 30 days did the following statement apply to you? Quote, I felt sexual desire, and on the PFSF indicated low desire, and responses of, quote, almost never or never, end quote, or a few times to the question, how often do you feel sexual desire and interest? So all these questions were asked, and hypoactive sexual desire function was defined as the presence of both low desire and sexually associated distress. Percentages show our absolute percentages, with eye bars indicating 95% confidence limits. So basically, the participants generally were less than 40, but went all the way up from 44 to 79. Let's look at the data. Available data suggests that less than 50% of persons with sexual difficulties that cause them distress seek help. Let's say that again. Available data suggests that less than 50% of persons with sexual difficulties that cause them distress seek help. Persons younger than 35 year age are most likely to seek support from the internet, whereas older patients are more likely to consult a physician. It's crucial to recognize that women who are unpartnered or sexually inactive may have sexual dysfunction, and that sexual dysfunction does not have an age limit. Establishing the recency of onset and whether the problem is generalized, situational, partner-specific is important. For example, lifelong sexual dysfunction is addressed by means of psychosocial care, whereas dysfunction that arises after bilateral oophorectomy may be effectively treated with hormone replacement. A full history will provide information about the menstrual irregularity and premenopausal women. We do note that there are gynecologic females who are into this business. I see in my practice that the girls are using pellet therapy. The pellet therapy is associated with putting in testosterone, a male hormone, make sure that their estrogen levels are high enough to get clinical response. And of course, talking to one of the gynecologists that can give them insight and basically point out that other people have this condition and that it's treatable. So let me just talk about pharmacotherapy a second. Although estrogen therapy is not a treatment for generalized sexual dysfunction, hormone therapy should be considered for menopausal symptoms that are troubling the patient because symptom relief may reduce sexual symptoms. There are different treatments. Pilobenzerin and bremelotide are approved in the United States for treatment of in premenopausal women with generalized acquired hypoactive sexual desire function. So again, that's an option. Estrogen is an option. Testosterone is an option. And there's many specialists in this Philadelphia, New Jersey marketplace that can go seek a gynecologist that basically are superb at getting this problem solved. I do want to point out that it's frequently used, for instance, patients in South America who are menopausal after 5 years frequently are treated with DHEA sulfate, and that's dehydroepiandrosterone therapy, has not been shown to improve sexual dysfunction in randomized double-blind clinical trials involving women with intact adrenals or with adrenal insufficiency. Yet, this can some gals can respond to DHEA. It's the most potent hormone over the counter in the United States. You can buy that in the pharmacy. Give it a try. So, understanding the physiology of female sexuality has been constrained by the necessary reliance on animal models, anatomical and functional studies involving humans and imaging. Overall, if you live in the Philadelphia marketplace, you have access to gynecologists who can help you out for sexual dysfunction. And that can be very rewarding. Gonna move on here in a second. Okay, so I want to talk about hyperglycemia and mortality. So one of the issues that takes into place is how to treat somebody with diabetes and how aggressively do you want to be. So time in hyperglycemia, not hypoglycemia, was associated with mortality in older patients with type 2 diabetes mellitus, a research study found. Data from the multicenter progressive study, HOPE-AGE study, using continuous glucose monitoring suggested that as many as a third of adults age 75 or older with type 2 diabetes are spending a higher than recommended amount of time in the hyperglycemic range, and that glycemic variability is independently associated with increased mortality. These findings were presented at the European Association for the Study of Diabetes. A index case was Carol, age 71, had a 9-week history of gradually worsening back disorder. So pain was an issue. And the question was, how did the American Diabetes, what was their recommendation to make sure that she was properly treated? One of the physicians in the study from the Joslin Geriatric Diabetic Program states, we really need to make sure older people are not suffering with hyperglycemia. Even if you don't think about long-term mortality, hyperglycemia is associated with dehydration, more infection, non-healing wounds, and decreases in cognition. Hyperglycemia is certainly not benign. So that's from Dr. Munchie at the Joslin Geriatric Diabetic Program. Again, we have sensors available. We hope that people are taking advantage of that. There actually is such a draw on sensors that there actually is a shortage. Some centers have them, some don't. But when you can apply that application, you know, to your arm, it's on usually for 2 weeks. And you can basically see your sugar every minute. It basically says, hey, what happened when I ate this food? What happened when I did this? What happened when I ran around the block? Of course, it gives you a lot of self-confidence because a lot of people don't like to get hypoglycemic. What about the benefit of those who have hypoglycemia in the middle of the night? A terrible thing. Kind of like I always tell my patients to please have a Coke at the bedside. People say, why Coke? It's because Coke's got bubbles. And the bubbles dilate the stomach and push the sugar water into the stomach, the initial part of the stomach, where you can absorb food much quicker. So Coca-Cola gets people out of hypoglycemia, usually in 12 to 13, 14 minutes. Whereas if you're using orange juice type of stuff, you're talking about 25 minutes. So again, get the Coke out. Additionally, if you have a problem with hypoglycemia, especially in the middle of the night, you can get those glucose gels, which the ambulance guys use. What's nice about a glucose gel, if you become unconscious, your partner can twist you to the side and squirt that into your cheek. The gels are thick, so therefore, even if you're unconscious, it doesn't go into the lungs. It goes to the stomach. So basically, you can treat it and wake you up. So again, glucose gels are fantastic. Don't use Coke if somebody is hypoglycemic and out of it. But treating hyperglycemia certainly generates a significant improvement to the stress on a body and better outcome. So there's been statements out, quote, glycemia might be the manifestation of how frailer and sicker and comorbid is in the population. Is that what they're looking at, rather than itself a driver of mortality? So again, we got to be able to make sure that patients' sugars are controlled. Got to make sure that when they go to bed, they're at least over 120. In my mind, it also depends on how old you are. But the sensors are fantastic. The glucose gels are fantastic. The person that sleeping next to you is fantastic if they can help you out with that hypoglycemia. So anyway, the doctor indicated that a study of long-term care facilities in the U.S. showed that more than half, i.e. 54%, spent over 10% of the time with glucose levels at over 250, and that 14% were spending more than 90% of that time in that range. In contrast, 26%, more than 1% of the time in hypoglycemic range. So even 20, that's in their definition of hypoglycemia is less than 70. So again, we have to make sure that people who are under long-term care don't have too much or too little, and that should make a big difference. And we appreciate Jocelyn's work in that regard. So one of the items that always comes up in my daily practice is magnesium levels. Cramping is kind of a common thing in the United States of America, and cramping can certainly hurt. Luckily, I haven't had a cramp in a while, but there was a little to do in New England Journal of Medicine about magnesium disorders. Quote, the authors pointed out that drug-induced hypomagnesemia and the increased prevalence of this anomaly among patients in the intensive care unit needs to be addressed. Basically, when people get dialysis, that tends to take out the magnesium, and they titrate out with magnesium citrate, which can generate more magnesium loss. Low serum magnesium levels are also found in the refeeding syndrome. Carbohydrate introduction after prolonged starvation is associated with an increase in plasma insulin that activates intracellular transport of glucose, magnesium, potassium. So again, in the ICU, the doctors are trained how to compensate for this. If you are an individual with leg cramps at night, like a patient I know, the medication that's used to get out of cramps is important. The one that seems to work the best under my patient care is Mag Oxide 400, usually available at places such as Walmart. If you look on the right-hand side, the magnesium product is $4.50. It doesn't work too well. If you look on the left side of the wall mount, is that it gets you a phenomenal result, Mag Oxide 400. If you take one at dinner, one at bedtime, you get out of those terrible cramps. So I'm for Mag Oxide 400. Remember, if you take two magnesium at the same time, you only get one. So it's important to take one and then take another at a different time. What I'm going to do right now is take a two-minute break, and I'll be back. Thank you.
Treat animals affects all of us. Cruelty overseas led to a pandemic, killing 1 million people. Help us fight back and make a better world for animals and people by visiting AmericanHumane.org and signing our New Deal for Animals.
Women Heart is in a race to save lives. Heart disease is the number one killer of women. It's 80% preventable if you know the facts. Millions of women are living with or at risk of heart disease. Get educated. See your doctor. Know the facts. To win this race, we all have to do it together. Our hearts beat as one. To learn more, visit womenheart.org.
Thank you. Be safe, look after yourself, and look after one another.
Go to firstrcf.org and help us help them.
I'm Ben Affleck, and I want to thank you for joining me and supporting Paralyzed Veterans of America.
I joined the Navy to serve my country as a Navy SEAL. While parachuting with my platoon, my parachute didn't open. And I broke my neck. It left me paralyzed. Paralyzed Veterans of America was by my side from that moment on.
Since 1946, Paralyzed Veterans of America has kept a promise to our wounded veterans. We will never leave a fallen comrade behind.
Thanks to PVA, paralyzed veterans are getting specialized medical care and treatments. The benefits they've earned, the jobs they want, and the accessible vehicles and homes they need.
I just don't think my family would be as happy as they are without the support that I received from Paralyzed Veterans of America.
Our veterans fought for us. Let's fight for them.
To learn more, go to PVA.org today.
Hi, Dr. Fallon, back again. Want to dovetail here into some thyroid disease issues. So thyroid disease is always big in the endocrine practice to make sure that people do well. Thyroid hormone has been on the market a long time. It has come a long way. And the question is, where are people getting titrated to with their thyroid levels? So just to start off, a TSH is the starting point for most doctors for evaluating how effective is their patient's metabolism. Now, the question is it a bell-shaped curve that we talk about getting patients to? And the question, if it's a bell-shaped curve, where do you want your hypothyroid patient to be? On the slow side, the fast side, the top 15% side. So Dr. Fallon is kind of more or less pushing most patients who don't have coronary artery disease into the top 15% or to the top 50%. So again, if you have a TSH value, that's what we judge. It usually starts at 0.3. That's going to be the fastest person. And say a 5 is going to be the slowest person, but that's in the normal range. So the question is, if you're a patient, doctor, where do you want my TSH to be? So myself, the range usually is 0.3 to a 5. So 0.3 is going to be the third person. The 5 is going to be the 97th person. And then you have a bell-shaped curve in between. So the issue is, do you want to be on the slow side or do you want to be on the fast side? So I titrate my TSH to a 1.5. I'd say the 80th percentile, because it's not a bell-shaped curve, is maybe going to be a 2.0. So the question is, do you want to be a 4.4? I say no. Now, if you have severe coronary artery disease, maybe you want to be that 4.5. But again, we want you in the normal range. But the question is, remember, it is not a bell-shaped curve, and that more people are on the low side of TSH than on the fast side. So when you give that thyroid pill, that goes into the bloodstream, and the bloodstream decides where your metabolism is going to be. So let's give an example of a stress state. Say you are in an auto accident, and you end up in the ICU trying to heal from what that steering wheel did to you and how much pain you have. So again, the doctor treating you in the ICU has to decide where he wants to put you based on your condition. So generally, most people, when I did my ICU work, we would titrate between 0.3 and a 2.0. Most of the time, we'd always be less than a 1.5, because the lower the TSH, the faster you are. So again, if you're on a thyroid pill, where did you and your doctor discuss where they want you to be? So again, if you're a 4.9, you're on the slow side of normal, but normal. And if you're a 0.3, you're on the fast side of normal, and probably a 1.5 is great for most people. And as we get older, a 2.0 might be great. So just remember, it's not a bell, it's a shift to the left type of curve. Now the question is, how do you make sure that if you check your lab work, that it's always interpretable? So the answer is that you can't eat and take your thyroid pill. You lose 40% of your thyroid pill to the gut, which goes out in the stool. So again, you have to basically, there's four recommendations on how to max out your thyroid. One is you should take your thyroid pill 1 hour before breakfast. That should work quite well. Some people can get by with 30 minutes before breakfast. So the national recommendations are, if you want to take a thyroid pill, you want to take it preferably 60 minutes before your first bite of breakfast or at bedtime, number two. Number three would be at least 30 minutes before dinner. Remember, at the bedtime one, you can't be eating either. And then the other one is going to be, you're going to take it 30 minutes before breakfast. Things to remember is that coffee binds 40% of your thyroid. What an unfair deal. Remember, that little pill only gets absorbed by about 25%. So it's a tough drug to get in. If you take it with food, you lose 40%. If you drink it with your coffee, you lose 40%. So that's why some people are just shocked at how come they were perfect, you know, 6 months ago, and now all of a sudden they're a disaster. Maybe it's because they decided to start drinking their coffee in the morning with their thyroid pill. Now, there is a little bit trick to the whole deal here, because thyroid pills, we always have heard of Synthroid. The government went after Synthroid and basically has kind of made sure that Synthroid's dose went up. And make sure the cost goes up. So when the cost goes up, people don't have enough money. And basically, you're talking about one of the most useful and available drug on the market to make sure that people have perk and pop with good metabolism. So if you're taking your coffee with it, you're going to lose 40%. If you're taking your breakfast with it, you're going to lose 40%. So again, the recommendations nationally are, if you're going to take a thyroid pill, number one pick would be 60 minutes before breakfast. Number two would be at bedtime. Number three would be 30 minutes before dinner. And number four would be 1 hour before dinner. 1 hour before dinner is fine. 30 minutes before dinner. Now, is all thyroid one pill, T4 levothyroxine? That's what most people use alone, but there is also one called Cytomel, not used by many doctors. Endocrinologists are used, the people who use it, but that gives you a 6 hour burst. And there's probably 15% of the population who thrives on that Cytomel burst. That Cytomel burst can be used generally twice a day. And you get this 6 hour bit of a burst. It's not like it's a nuclear war here, but basically it gives you that perk so that you can time maybe your initial day on the job, or maybe get it to make sure that you've got a lot of perk before you go home on the job. So again, T4, classically Synthroid. Unithroid is American made. I like both of those products. Generics I hate, because the Chinese have kind of infiltrated the drug supply, and a lot of the thyroid pills are coming from China. Again, what's the what is the quality and batch-to-batch uniformity of China medication? I would say not too good. And you have to remember that the Chinese also had carcinogens in the SGLT2 blood pressure pills a few years ago with contamination. So I prefer to go with American. So that's kind of the flavor. You got Synthroid and you got Unithroid, which are highly quality American products, and get good batch-to-batch uniformity. Now, the question is how long does it take to get somebody a thyroid dose? So in other words, if you have somebody, you put them on thyroid medication and they come back 6 weeks later, get a lab draw, come in and see you 2 weeks after that, the question is, where are you going to put that patient? You ask them how they feel. They can put their hands out. If their hands are shaking, that's not a good thing. If they have a tremor, that's not a good thing either. So again, we just want to make sure that you have an idea where you want to be. Do you want to be a 2.0, a 1.5? Do you want to be a 0.3, or do you want to be a 5? So basically, the lower numbers are quicker. So my overall impression is that thyroid hormone is important. Make sure you don't take your thyroid pill with the food. Make sure you don't take it with your coffee. And make sure you get it checked appropriately at the time. Additionally, we can move on to blood pressure pills. I just want to make sure that everybody knows that blood pressure pills are very important. Getting them in respectively all the time with a good modus operandi is where you want to be. And if your blood pressure pill is better, so I think will be your blood vessels, which won't have to take these big high hits. My overall impression is that blood pressure pills make a difference for so many people in the U.S., and we want to make sure that they keep on going. My impression is that we looked like I've run out of time. Please come back next week. Joe Fallon signing off, Inside Medicine. Remember, the podcast is at www.wwdbam.com. Hit Inside Medicine, and you can review the podcast. Thank you very much. Dr. Fallon signing off.